Parents be warned, this message may contain content which is unsuitable for younger listeners. Your discretion is advised. This week we will be considering Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, both of which contain a series of blessings and curses, the former for obedience to God's laws, and the latter for disobedience. We'll also be considering Deuteronomy 30, which gives encouragements to keep the law and contemplates the hope of those who repent of their sins. You could read all three of those chapters, but much of it will be repetitive, so your recommended reading is Deuteronomy 28 and 30. If you haven't yet read those chapters, I recommend that you pause and do so now. So this week we've got a long list of blessings and curses, but before I break these down, I want to talk about the corporate as opposed to individual nature of these blessings and curses. God was pronouncing these things to a nation, his whole people. He was not pronouncing them to any one individual. So when we apply these blessings and curses, we need to be sure not to apply them on an individual basis. Philosophers have long been vexed with the question, why do good things happen to bad people, and why do bad things happen to good people? And that specifically is another topic for another day, but it is certain that at some point we will all experience this. You might be a person who strives to follow God's laws, or maybe you know a person who strives to follow God's laws, and yet you or that other person will still suffer sickness and death and isolation and so forth. You might look at this list of blessings and curses and ask yourself, where did I go wrong? Didn't God promise to bless me if I obey? And at the same time, you'll see some person who hates God and despises his laws walking away with health and wealth and prosperity and popularity and everything else which is preferable. And you'll ask yourself, shouldn't that person be the one cursed? And the answer is no. A bad thing happening in your life doesn't necessarily mean that you're being punished for a specific sin, and something good happening in your life doesn't necessarily mean that you're being rewarded for righteousness. It doesn't work that way. And the passage doesn't claim that it works that way. There isn't a one-to-one correspondence here. Rather, the passage speaks to a larger corporate trend. If everyone in a large group is obedient, then that group will be generally more blessed than a comparable group which is disobedient. Both groups will have poverty, and both groups will have riches. But if there are more righteous people in a group who work harder and use their resources more wisely, who don't steal and who punish those who do, then in general, that group will be richer. On the other hand, the group that doesn't work, and which steals, and which doesn't punish theft, and which wastes its resources, will be poorer in general. And the same goes for the spread of disease, leading to death, or what have you. A group of good people characterized by clean living will never completely eliminate disease, but they will be less sickly than a group characterized by decadent, foolish living. So while you personally will likely be better off for having obeyed God's laws than you would have been if you had not obeyed, that won't always be the case. In general, your fortunes will likely be tied to a larger social sphere, and as they say, a rising tide will lift all boats, but a lowering one will sink them all. As your society is more obedient, your life will likely be better. As your society is less obedient, your life will likely be worse. I also want to note the practicality of these commands. What do you suppose the purpose is for God having given these laws? We honor God by obedience to his laws, but we should not presume that these laws have some direct impact on him. God doesn't need our honor. He doesn't need anything, and nothing we do can change him. God is who he is. To that end, God is not personally injured when we disobey. He is hurt in the sense that he is disappointed and angry when we do wrong. But he's disappointed and angry because he loves his people and doesn't want his people to be harmed. And he is angry because he's been disobeyed and disrespected. In a like manner, he is pleased when we obey his laws because he loves us and he wants what is best for us. He doesn't want us to hurt one another. So the laws were not really given for God's sake. The laws are given for our sakes. The laws are good laws, and they help the people who obey them. Likewise, those who disobey these laws suffer for that. All the world is created with the purpose of glorifying God, and it is designed such that by its nature, creation lashes out at those who disrespect the created order which puts God as king. Obedience to God's laws is in harmony with the natural created order. So obedience to these laws is best for us because it conforms us to what is naturally right. God is not some old man in the sky holding a stick with which he might hit us for the sake of some kind of cruel pleasure, and he does not need to directly intervene in every case for punishment to come on those who are disobedient. Neither does he need to intervene to shower down blessings. The world he created itself will bless those who honor God's laws and will curse those who fail to obey. So God is glorified in our obedience. Obedience is in our natural best interest, and God is pleased when we have our best interest. Likewise, God is disrespected in our disobedience, which works naturally to our harm, and he is displeased when we are harmed. So obedience is good, and disobedience is bad. And of course, none of that is said to exclude the reality of divine intervention. God does get involved in human affairs. The scriptures abound with stories of him actively blessing those whom he favors and cursing those whom he does not, as is very clearly demonstrated in the Torah's account of the Exodus from Egypt. So then, now that we have an idea about the purposes and mechanisms behind these blessings and curses, let's move on to an examination of the list itself. Let's start with the blessings for obedience. First and perhaps foremost, an obedient people will have a special relationship with God. In Leviticus 26:11, God promises in exchange for obedience, quote, "I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. And I will walk among you, and will be your God, and you shall be my people." That from the English Standard Version, which I will be quoting throughout. This blessing will carry with it international strength and distinction. Deuteronomy 28:1 says that for the people which faithfully obeys God, he will set them high above all the other nations. Verse 10 of that chapter says that all the other people of the earth will see this distinction, that God's people are called by his name and that they will be afraid of his people. This international strength will include economic strength. We'll talk a bit more about economic strength as connected to God's laws a bit further on, but we note that a people characterized by economic justice will naturally have greater riches. Verses 12 through 13 of Deuteronomy 28 tell us that a God-fearing people will lend to many nations but will not borrow, and that God's people will become the head while the others become the tail. So if we obey God, we'll be leading and they'll be following. We'll be the richer and they'll be the poorer. We'll be the stronger and they'll be the weaker. They'll need us and we won't need them. They'll serve us and we won't serve them. And of course, international strength and distinction will be accompanied by military victory. Deuteronomy 28:7 says that the enemies of a God-honoring people will be defeated in battle, coming from one direction but scattering and fleeing in seven. And of course, we recall that the law gives good laws for a strong economy and a large population, both of which are helpful in war. The law also gives good guidelines for how war should be conducted. God's people were to maintain cleanliness in the field to limit disease, and they were to help ensure their provision by not destroying fruit trees. And they were to send only willing soldiers into battle, that their forces should not be discouraged and faint-hearted. As a result of obedience, as God says in Leviticus 26:6 through 8, "I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid." Skipping ahead, "And the sword shall not go through your land. You shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. Five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall chase 10,000, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword." And the blessings will not only be international, but also domestic. Generally, these blessings are blessings of fruitfulness, both agricultural and reproductive. And of course, the blessings of many people and good crops, the accumulation of wealth, feed into the international victories described above. Concerning the agricultural blessings, God promised his people rain. He promised them strong crop yields and large herds of livestock. He promised them fruitful vines and trees, and an abundance such that they never ran out of the things they needed, such that they could have security, food without worry. He promised them plentiful bread with full baskets and kneading bowls and barns. And not only this, but he promised to bless them with prosperity in all their work. And it makes sense. God promised to give the people a good land, and by nature they can work that good land and make good food. And not only this, but God gave them laws to ensure that people were treated justly. They could own their land and the fruits produced from their land with a low tax burden, so they would be motivated to work. They could have fair and free trade in just markets, so they would have competition and profit motivations urging them to always grow their best. The law offered them penalties for stealing, such that there is no cheating the system. As such, the best way to get rich was to do good work rather than taking advantage of someone else. And with a system of restitution rather than a system of fines and prisons, everyone's efforts could be maximized and the state would never have a motivation to oppress the people. Essentially, a people obedient to God's laws would be living in the best kind of economic conditions, and as a result, they would work the hardest, earn the most, and keep the most of what they earned. And that's even before God gives his divine intervention, keeping animals and plants healthy, giving good rains, and so forth. The people were also promised reproductive blessing, large, healthy families, carrying their language and ideas and culture to change a dark world. Much contrary to the American culture of death and sterilization, I agree with the Bible that many children are a great blessing and source of strength, both social and military. God promised several times throughout our passages, Deuteronomy 28:4 and 11, as well as Leviticus 26:9, that he would bless the fruit of the womb and multiply the God-fearing people. And this also makes natural sense. If your people are getting rich, they can afford babies. If your people are winning wars, they have room to spread out. And if your people are healthy, they have a capacity to reproduce. God's laws heavily emphasize sexual purity. Bestiality, homosexuality, fornication, and adultery, all of which are vectors for the transfer of diseases which can kill or cause sterilization or otherwise harm reproductive health, are forbidden. So if the people are obedient, they can expect to have increased reproduction. And of course, sexual immorality is also harmful for social and familial health, which limits reproduction. Not only that, but dietary and other cleanliness laws promoted good health, which would be beneficial for longevity and robust reproduction. And furthermore, the people who obey God will simply be blessed in everything. God promised, for instance, in Leviticus 26:6, to rid the land of dangerous beasts, such that the people would not be harmed by them. God said that they would be blessed in the city and blessed in the field, blessed when they came out and blessed when they went in. God promised to bless them in all that they would undertake. And I can't give you an exhaustive list of all the ways that obedience to God's laws can help people, but I have endeavored to point these things out as we've studied through, so if you've paid close attention, you know by now. The fact is this: by both divine intervention and by natural consequence, obeying God's laws makes life better for the people who obey them. And then, of course, there is the other side of this, that curses befall those who do not obey God's laws. These curses are essentially the opposite of what we have listed above, but with even more added. The curses take up about 3 times as much space as the blessings did, which makes it clear to me that God intended for these people to give special attention to all the horrible things that would fall on them if they would disobey Jehovah. For those who walk in disobedience, there will be no special relationship with God. Leviticus 26:30 tells us that for their disobedience, God will abhor them. Deuteronomy 28 tells us that God would cast the people away into foreign slavery, where they would be forced to serve false gods, and Leviticus tells us that he would cast their dead bodies down on their idols. So, how do they get there? Well, if you ask me, the decline starts with sexual immorality. Disease spreads as a result. People start suffering from the itch and the boils and the ailments of Egypt. All those nasty little infections that the doctors can't cure, but which could have been avoided if only the people had kept their pants on. Soon enough, people stop having healthy children and healthy families. More and more women can't have kids at all. More and more, the ones that they do have are born sick. Deuteronomy 28:18 calls it a curse on the fruit of the womb. And wild beasts come back to roam the fields, because the people are too few and too weak to ward them away. And then there's agricultural failure. The skies are like bronze for their dryness, and the earth like iron for its rock-hard quality. Drought and worms and crop-wasting disease set in. When people don't care for their environment, when they don't care for their animals, when they don't keep things clean, when they don't tend to their work, these things happen naturally. But when God intervenes, it becomes much worse. And we have to ask why people even would continue to work. Because when they work, they don't get to keep what they have. The taxes are high, and the many officers produce little and eat much. The courts are unjust, and so the thieves run wild. Deuteronomy 28:29-31 puts it well. And you shall be only oppressed and robbed continually, and there shall be no one to help you. You shall betroth a wife, but another man shall ravish her. You shall build a house, but you shall not dwell in it. You shall plant a vineyard, but you shall not enjoy its fruit. Your ox shall be slaughtered before your eyes, but you shall not eat any of it. Your donkey shall be seized before your face, but shall not be restored to you. And so forth. Well, I don't know if any of you have ever been robbed in such a manner before, by thieves or officials, either one, but I have. These verses strike close to home for me. So there's economic woe in a society which begins to abandon God. People stop having kids. They can't afford them. They can't even afford to keep their wives at home to raise the kids they've got. And when all these things happen, the people are poor. They are angry. They are sick. They are few. They can't get along. And what do you suppose happens then? Internal rebellions, international weakness, military failure, and in the most advanced stages, dispersion into slavery. It starts with economic weakness. Low production leads to low revenue. There's international debt and a trade deficit. More and more, the people who once served God and held the lead find that they are the tail while their enemy is the head. Does that sound familiar to anyone? The people are plagued by crime and infighting and mounting debts to fund a system required to care for their sick. Does that sound familiar? And when it all advances far enough, the enemy sees his chance and he marches in. You think it can't happen here? It can't happen to you? Don't kid yourself. When the siege comes, it is bitter, so bitter that there is no food. The man begrudges the last morsel to his wife, and the wife kills her own child so that she can have something to eat. Even the kindest and daintiest woman among them contemplates it. And do you suppose they wouldn't? I look around at my fellow Americans, and I see a giant pile of 40 million aborted babies killed in just the last few decades for the purpose of saving a few bucks and to help their mothers advance in society. And we aren't even under a siege. So you don't suppose that people of such a depraved moral character would be willing to kill their own children to prolong their lives under such desperate circumstances? Don't bet on it. And eventually the fighting breaks out. The men aren't fighting for the love of God, of course. They're fighting because they were drafted, and they're undersupplied, weak, sick. They die in the fields, food for the birds, and no one comes to rescue them. The women are raped and the children are taken as slaves. Those who survive spend their days staring at the horizon, wearing themselves out with the false hope that their loved ones would return. But they don't. You don't think that can happen here? Gangs of criminals are already pouring over the borders. I wonder how many little girls have already been grabbed off the street and sold into prostitution. I hear reports about sex trafficking on the news all the time. And you know what I hate most about it? I hate that it can only happen in a society so perverse that there's a customer base willing to pay for it. Well, maybe that isn't quite the war scenario that we see described in the scriptures, but it looks like moving in that direction to me. And finally, the people are scattered. They live as slaves. They are forced by cruel masters to worship the false gods that they once trusted to protect them. In their own country, they were allowed to choose whether or not they wanted to serve Jehovah, the one true God. And since they chose not to, well, now they're stuck with that choice, under the thumb of masters who tell them in a strange tongue that there is no God and that anyone who serves Jehovah will die for it. Particularly in the case of Israel in Leviticus 26, they were warned that they would go into exile until the land could enjoy its Sabbath, the days and years of rest that they refused to give it. And in fact, all of this is what happened to Israel. They suffered under siege, they lost the war to Babylon, they went into exile, and they stayed gone for 70 years. Do you think it can't happen to you? Do you think it can't happen to the people you love? Well, maybe it won't. Maybe for now we'll just get comfortable with the opening stages of this and not suffer the most advanced penalties. But I don't like the way things have been trending. We're seeing the outbreaks of disease, we're seeing the wealth gap ever widening, we're seeing people so poor that they sterilize their wives, murder their unborn children, and abandon those that are born to the care of the state. We're seeing the repression, the socialist tendencies, the crime in the streets, the overloaded prisons, the police officers killing and being killed. We're seeing the hopelessness of a people who have to medicate themselves to get out of bed in the morning. You know, at one time, people weren't afraid to leave their doors unlocked because they lived in a society of righteous people whom they knew would not rob them. Well, today, in some places, you have to be afraid to let your kids go outside because someone might snatch them. In this country and in the Western world in general, we're seeing debts going ever higher, trade deficits growing, partisanship ever more divided and more fierce. Drug cartels are starting to dominate the borders. Foreigners migrate in and eat up the bread with no concern for our God or our laws. More and more, you don't recognize the language being spoken by the person in the cubicle next to yours. Well, how long do you think it will be before your government, your people, your culture, your religion, your language collapses entirely from a failure to abide by God's laws? How long do you think it will be before your descendants are taken as slaves? Before your sons are cast out in the field as food for wild animals? Don't give me your American pride. Don't tell me that your military can protect you. If God wants you to go, you'll go. Maybe it won't happen today. Maybe it won't happen tomorrow. Maybe not even in our lifetimes. I'm thankful that Americans are still living on the Christian capital generated by our ancestors in years gone by. And I'm thankful that there is still a resilient core of people who are fully sold out for the faith, who honor God's laws, and who are fighting to keep the rest of society afloat. But I'm going to tell you now, that core can only do so much. And if we lose that core, or we allow that core to continue to shrink, the investment of our forefathers in moral living won't last forever. And one of these days, what was once the Christian world will be staring down slavery. So then, we have it that for a people who disobey God's commands, all the blessings will be turned in reverse. A good relationship will turn bad. Health will turn to disease. Wealth will turn to poverty, strength will turn to weakness, freedom will turn to slavery, and ultimately life will turn to death. So I think that all God's people, including both ancient Israel and modern believers, should heed the warnings of Deuteronomy 28:47-48. Because you did not serve the Lord your God with joyfulness and gladness of heart because of the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies whom the Lord will send against you in hunger and thirst, in nakedness and lacking everything, and he will put a yoke of iron on your neck until he has destroyed you. But now I want to get to the good news, found in Deuteronomy chapter 30. There is forgiveness available, even for a people which has gone all the way down this long road of sin, decline, enslavement, and death. We read of it in Deuteronomy 30 and verses 1 through 3. When all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice in all that I command you today, with all your heart and with all your soul, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have mercy on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. And also in Leviticus 26, where verses 40 through 42 read, "But if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers and their treachery that they have committed against me, and also in walking contrary to me, so that I walked contrary to them and brought them into the land of their enemies, if then their uncircumcised heart is humbled and they make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember my covenant with Isaac, and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember the land." Deuteronomy 30 also lists off for us the blessings for a repentant people, and we find that these are essentially the same blessings that any obedient people enjoyed. Their special relationship with God is restored, their hearts are circumcised, and they can obey again. They are restored to their land, they are given fruit of the womb and growth in numbers, they are given the wealth of agricultural production, and the curses of God fall on their enemies. God is not spiteful. He doesn't hold a grudge, and neither does the nature which he created. The more disobedient a society is, and the longer it remains that way, the worse its situation becomes. But when a people repents and returns, the longer they remain in that state of obedience, the better their situation becomes. God doesn't hold on to the former sins. He forgives them, and he restores the people just as they were before. And so at any stage along this spectrum between great blessings and horrible curses, there exists a choice. And hear me clearly. It is a choice between life and death. It is a choice between freedom and slavery. It is a choice between blessing and curses. It is a choice between good things and bad things. This, it seems, should not be a choice which is hard for you to make. Do you want to live your best possible life? If so, then the way for you to have that is for you and everyone around you to obey these laws. Do you want to live your worst possible life? If so, then you should disobey these laws, and you should live among a people who disobey these laws. You would think that everyone would choose life and prosperity over death and misery, but here's the big problem. Obedience to the laws requires a few things out of a person: selflessness, humility, and a willingness to invest in the greater good. Obedience to the law requires selflessness. At some point, you're going to have to drop your own best interest and work for the good of all society. And you will also have to drop your pride. You'll have to be able to admit when you're wrong, and you'll have to be able to submit yourself to God's rules and the guidance of his people in implementing them. And it will require you to give up what appears to be in your immediate best interest so that you can have greater long-term benefits. You'll have to trust God for those. In the moment, every sin looks enticing. Every sin looks like it is something good. Otherwise, people wouldn't fall into them. And so this is what people do when they sin. They look at a tempting situation contrary to God's laws, and they say, "Forget what consequences might come later, or what might come on others. I'm looking out for myself, and I'm looking out for right now. I'm going to do whatever will make me feel good right this minute. And I'm going to reject the authorities which God has ordained by his word, making up my own mind about what is right and never bending." That's pride. It's selfishness, and it is instant gratification. But it doesn't work in the long term, it doesn't work for everyone, and ultimately it doesn't work for you. You know, God emphasized throughout these passages that the people shouldn't turn to other gods to bow down and serve them. I will suggest to you that the God which you most need to avoid serving is the one which you make in your own image, and which is inclined toward giving you whatever it is that you want right now, everyone else be damned. I adjure you then to set yourself aside. Subject your own judgment to the word of God. Abstain from instant gratification and seek the greater good of society over yourself by obeying these laws, whether it is comfortable and easy for you or not. Because that is the path that will lead you and the people around you to the best possible ultimate outcome. Please, this is a choice between life and death, and I will humble myself so much as to beg of you, do not choose death. Choose life. So those are the blessings and the curses, and they make for a good conclusion to the law. Herein we learned that the laws can be obeyed, and that it is good to obey them. Obedience to the law brings blessings, including agricultural and economic prosperity, functional society, healthy bodies and reproductive function, strength in international affairs, and most importantly, a special connection to God. In short, life is good for a people who obey God's laws. And on the other hand, the farther a people strays from obedience to God's laws, the worse life gets for them. The wealth of the people is ruined, their relationships are ruined, they are sick, they are weak, and God is against them. In extreme cases, these people suffer death and exile. Of course, we don't expect to find a one-to-one correspondence here. These passages don't speak to each individual so much as they speak to the general condition of a whole society. And while an individual so afflicted may not ever recover from his affliction, a people as a whole might. God promises that when his people turn from their sins in repentance, that he will restore them to their land and their prosperity. It is my sincere hope that American Christians and Christians everywhere can learn this lesson. God is forgiving, and if we as a people will break ranks with the world and return to God, obeying his laws, then he will lift the curses which we have been seeing in our society, and he will restore us and bless us. We have laid before us today a choice between life and death. We can continue with our arms linked to the world, walking down a path dishonoring to him and continuing toward death, or we can choose to break ranks, make our own way, and walk on the path toward life. The choice is yours. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.